This episode of Camp Nightmare is brought to you by Wonder Book and Video.
Go to wonderbk.com today.
Future Fantascope and the Nerd Camp Network present Camp Nightmare, a podcast for happy campers. There'll be fun, fiends, and ghosts, maybe even a few murders. And of course, you're all invited.
Hello, campers!
Welcome back to spooky-ass October. My name is JB.
And I'm Jordan, and we are 1 week closer to Halloween.
Here at Camp Nightmare. Welcome back. So today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite real-life, quote-unquote, hauntings. Maybe the granddaddy of all of them in America, at least. The Bell Witch haunting, of course.
It's like a good dose of American haunting. It's a dash of true crime. It's a whole lot of hearsay.
Whole lot of hearsay. So much so that they actually made a movie about it in 2005 called An American Haunting, starring Donald Sutherland.
Because there's a dash of true crime in the episode, and because it's 1 week from Halloween, we are welcoming back our special guest, Callie Valentine, to the show. She'll be joining us to talk about the Bell Witch, and that's always a good time.
And we always love talking to Kelly, even if the majority of this episode is me talking at Kelly.
But before we get into any of that,
let's get into some what's new.
Up first, Halloween will never die. And I don't mean the holiday either.
No,
I mean Michael
fucking
Myers.
Fucking franchise.
So the rights to the Halloween franchise just went through a heated battle over to who's going to buy the property next, because they cannot let it die.
So A24 went hard for it.
People thought they were the forerunner. People thought they were going to come out. And honestly, I would be interested to see a world in which A24 did a Halloween
At the
film.
End of the day, though, Miramax got it. Which is shocking to me, because it feels like Miramax would be bankrupt now because of Harvey Weinstein.
No.
But apparently they're not.
Oh, no. Miramax is chugging hard. I'm not surprised. Miramax is the heavy hitter between them and A24.
Well, they had all that rape money.
Yeah,
so,
all
you know.
So I don't know what they're going to do besides it's going to be a TV series.
But there are rumors, there are musings, there are whispers.
Yes.
And we're not signing off on any of this officially, but there are whispers that it may be a TV series set in the Halloween 3 season of the Witch universe, if that's the case, you boys are here for that.
That changes everything.
I just watched Season of the Witch last night.
Love it.
Every time I watch that movie, I'm reminded how much that's my favorite Halloween movie. Hands down, period, no matter what.
It's a great Halloween movie. It's definitely one of my top in the franchise. Directed by Tommy Lee Wallace. And speaking of Tommy Lee Wallace, up next on What's New, Stephen King news. Tommy Lee Wallace once did a Stephen King adaptation for television, which many of you may remember. It was entitled The Langoliers.
Starring the incomparable Mr. Bronson Pinchot.
Yes.
If you may remember him from a little TV, if you're old like me, you'll remember from a little TV show in the 80s and 90s called Perfect Strangers as Balky Bartokoulos.
It was a highly anticipated television event, and I think it's still redeemed as one of the more regrettable Stephen King adaptations.
With the hungry meatballs.
And I personally have fond memories of it, because I saw it when I was very young, and I was like, wow, this is crazy.
Yeah, I remember being, I don't think I was as young as you, because I'm like almost a decade older than you. No, I'm not that much older than you, but I remember watching The Langoliers as maybe like an 11 or 12 year old, and being fucking terrified.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe older than that. But I remember it when it came out, and I remember when it came out, I think David Morris is in it, Bronson Pinchot's in it. It was pretty scary in its own way.
And it's very high
on
concept.
On a rewatch, the whole premise of that story is very high concept.
Yeah.
Like the idea of these like weird hungry meatballs that eat time.
Right,
like,
they eat what time leaves over behind. It's a pretty insane concept.
Yeah, like it was definitely written at a weird time in Stephen King's life. It's definitely one of those I stopped using drugs stories.
Oh, 100%.
There's a whole lot of drugs involved in the writing of the story.
And the reason we bring up Tommy Lee Wallace's The Langoliers is because now another Stephen King filmmaker adaptator, Rob Savage, who just did The Boogeyman.
Which I did finally watch.
Yeah.
And I was pleasantly surprised by that film.
Right.
I did not think I was going to like it.
I was surprised that it was so good, too, because, I mean, it is very much like a Hollywoodized version of, like, the Stephen King story. and a much less dark story than its source material, but I think they did a pretty good job with
it. I think it's like a really, really good episode of Goosebumps.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
But Rob Savage now wants to do his version of the Langoliers. So he's got his sights set on the Langoliers. He's got stars in his eyes. And he says, quote,
again, like,
there's a good chance.
Out of all the properties that you could choose, like, why Langoliers?
No
why
idea.
One of the most high concept, almost impossible to translate?
It speaks to Rob
stories,
Savage. So we wish him the best. We'll see what happens with that. Up next, speaking of adaptations, we got some Gargoyles news. Earlier, we said that Kenneth Branagh had his sight set on this. And Greg Wiseman, who's like the creator of Gargoyles, basically said that that was not happening and that the movie adaptation was not happening. But then now we have this adaptation that's basically been confirmed by James Wan on his social media that his company, Atomic Monster, and his
production partner.
Yeah, his production partner, Gary Dauerman, who's written a lot of his stuff and is now directing a lot of things, will be taking on the franchise.
Dude, I'm here for that.
I think that's a better match than
Kenneth actually Branagh. Happy that Kenneth Branagh is not involved in this because his Thor, he made the original Thor film, and I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think that the MCU needed Branagh for like credit.
Mm-hmm. I do think I think we've seen that he's a little too dry for
that
stuff, though.
That exactly is that he is not. His version of pathos is not genre movie pathos.
Right. It's more Shakespearean. I think that's why he's
very much so. And like his version of Henry V, amazing.
Sure.
His version of Hamlet,
great.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah.
I don't want to see him do a live action version of a Disney cartoon.
Right. But I see why like a Shakespearean approach to Gargoyles makes sense.
Yeah, but it just never sat well with me.
No, I think this is a better choice personally.
For
and
sure.
Maybe that's me because I'm a genre.
Well, and
guy.
I think James Wan, you know, I've been going back through the Saw franchise because Greg and I saw Saw 10 in the theater, and bear in mind that movie is fucking terrible.
Sure.
That it's definitely a Saw movie, and it's fun in that regard. But so I've been going back through them, and that led me down the rabbit hole of going back through some other James Wan franchise stuff and one-off stuff. And the thing I really appreciate about James Wan is that he is like equal parts pathos and drama and understands how to insert that in there, but he also knows how to be very cartoonish and
right.
have a lot of fun with stuff. Like, go watch his Aquaman. It's brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
And I think it's the best DC movie that was made, and I think a lot of people hated on it because it was DC. And maybe it's not the best thing that he's done, but he's able to walk that line between, again, pathos and like, ooh, look, colors and explosions.
Yeah, and I think Gary Dauberman knows that too. He wrote our screenplays for the It movies, and those movies
and they're
do
brilliant.
That.
Dude, It Chapter 2 in particular.
Does
I,
that.
I watched the It series recently as well, and It Chapter 2, the thing I like about It Chapter 2 is that it does that, but it's also so mean. Mm. Like, that movie is mean-spirited. So in the first, in Andy Muschietti's It Chapter 1, you never actually see Pennywise kill anything.
Right.
You always see it right up to the moment, and then you see the aftermath. And It Chapter 2, within the first, like, 20 minutes of that movie, you see him bite the top of a kid's head clean off.
It's
and,
good.
Like, that shit is mean spirit.
It is.
And
I still much prefer part one. Something about part two for me, but I
think
gotta watch
part
them together.
Well, I think that the story in part one is better written. I think that part two is a whole, like, the story of part one is a lot of let's flesh this out and build up to what's going to happen when they're adults.
Yeah.
And most, I would argue that probably 80% of the people that went to go see that movie in the theater, at least 80%, had read the book.
Yeah.
So they already knew, like, how the story was going to plot out. So I think that the reason It Chapter 2 doesn't hold as much weight as Chapter 1 movie-wise is because it was really just a lot of payoff visually without the same meat of writing behind it.
Well, I think it was like, I don't know, I think it lacked some of the dread of the first one, and I think it's probably because, like, Get Dauberman didn't write the entire first script. It was adapted from
Carrie
Fukunaga's script, which was, like, all dread, and then it was, like, adapted to Gary Dauberman's style.
And I think Andy Muschietti had a lot to do with it, the first script as well, making it as accurate to Stephen King's vision as possible.
Yeah.
I will say in Chapter 2, though, one of the things that really sticks out for me is the scene at Jade of the Orient.
Yeah, great scene.
Is so well done. Like, anybody who's read the book knows how important that scene is because that's them, like, reconnecting with each other. And it literally, like, when you read that, if you're a Stephen King constant reader like we are, it'll bring tears to your eyes because it's just such a good example of how Stephen King writes emotion. And I think that Muschietti really gets that in that movie. Is
he does a great
and the
job.
Actors do too.
That's an impressive scene. Like just like well, a really impressively shot scene, and like that whole scene is just really well done.
Well, and the whole scene where Bill Hader is Richie is talking about Eddie's mom, and he's like, and she leaned in and said, "Isa no waba nuki jibble," and starts like Jabba
it's
the
so
Hutt.
Real. Oof. Like it's and that's what's impressive about that scene is they're shooting a scene that covers six primary characters and still allowing them room to improv, and yet they're still covering six characters like that's and sticking to a script.
Well, and also, dude, the scene in the original 1990 miniseries at the Jade of the Orient, I think,
is great.
At least comparable to that.
Yeah, that's one of my 100%.
Yeah, and I mean, you gotta wonder whether or not Muschietti made them just hang out with each other for a few days before that scene to like get comfortable being friends with each other, because the way that they all just slowly open up to each other, and then by the end of that scene, they're the kids again.
Yeah. I wonder in where they put that in the schedule. Because something that I've done in the last two films, something that I think I'm going to continue doing, is usually you have your scene in the beginning when all your characters are like interacting and before bad stuff starts happening to them. I've started shooting those dead last.
Good.
So that like they have the entire movie's worth of shooting scenes to get to know each other. Mm-hmm. And then when you shoot the scene, when you're first meeting them, they've had all that time to already warm up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so much more natural.
Well, I know one of the things that Muschietti did do when shooting it was he made all of the adult actors spend weeks with the children, with the child version of themselves ahead of time. Like Bill Hader and Wolf Fenhard. Spent like weeks with each other beforehand because they... Muschietti wanted the transition between the two of them to be smooth.
And it was.
And it's more Bill Hader acting to Finn Wolfhard.
Yeah, because you have to.
Right? Like,
they've established the characters already, and you can't change that.
Like I know that I'm kind of like sucking the dick of that movie right now, but I will tell you hands down that Bill Hader is my favorite adult.
Oh,
in that film,
hands down.
Very close second is James McAvoy as Bill, as old Bill, because you could really see a direct through line between the child actor and how James McAvoy acts in that. Like, he's clearly a traumatized grown-up version of Bill.
Yeah.
But, dude, Bill Hader in that movie is just so good at playing this sort of man-child that, like, never grew out of who Richie is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, anyway.
That is Richie.
Exactly.
You can't grow out of it.
So, up last on What's New, I'm so glad we got to talk about it because I love that fucking franchise, but up last on What's New, sequel news, Prey, No Man's Land is coming to Hulu.
So this is a sequel to a prequel, so I suppose it just makes it a regular sequel.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a prequel.
Yeah, but it's like, I kind of see it as the beginning of this franchise of, like, Predator in historical moments.
Sure,
right?
And there is precedent set for that in the comics.
And I think it's sweet. So this one, Prey, No Man's Land, it's a World War II Predator movie.
Interesting.
So I'm here for it.
If it's Predator murdering Nazis, I'm here for that.
I think it's going to be Predator murdering Nazis.
As long as it's not like Predator like eventually forming some sort of loose consortium with World War II GIs to kill Nazis. That will make me angry.
Because
Predator has no ties politically.
Has no affiliation.
It's
got to be like, warfare between the Nazis and then like Predator shows up, you know?
Yeah. So I'll be honest with you. I watched Prey again recently.
Yeah.
And I still stand by my big issue with it is that the Predator is wearing outdated...
The loincloth. That's
I just
issue.
Don't understand why a species that's advanced enough to cross the stars is going to use fucking outdated weaponry and armor, even though it doesn't do that for any other thing that it hunts. But either way,
there is
no other Predator movie where it dumbs its armor and weapons down to, like, be fair.
But we've never seen the Predator at this period in time before.
It's fair, and maybe it learned from this. Maybe too many Predators died because they did dumb down, and it learned by the time it got to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It's like, you can't give the kids the ancient armor. Just give the kids what everyone else uses when you send them down.
Yep. Either way, we're looking forward to this. Prey, No Man's Land. So should you. Up next, our steaming pile of streaming picks.
Up first, and of most utter importance, Netflix, The Fall of the House of Usher, is a masterpiece. Mikey Flanagan has done it again. It's a very different take on what Mike Flanagan does. You know, Flanagan has usually given us very cathartic characters that we care about.
There's no one in this series that's good.
This is like all of his characters are spiteful and mean, and like this is a very biting take on like, on opulent wealth and upper class society.
Motherfucking chef's kiss is what I have to say.
So
about
good.
This. Even the character, and I'm not going to spoil this for people, that you think is good, that you think has altruistic intentions in this movie, is ultimately bad.
And
it's fucking great.
It's fantastic.
Mike Flanagan, kudos to you, dude. If you're going to go out with a fucking bang.
Yeah, this is what a way to leave Netflix is to with a bang like this. So I'm just excited to see what he does next up over on Amazon. Speaking of Amazon, our next pick is Totally Killer.
Such a delight.
So this is a really fun watch.
If you're looking for something that's just bloody and fun to watch.
And Back to the Future-y.
And you don't have to think too much about it. And it's got a pretty hefty, decent cast.
Yeah. It's a good
Give it a watch, man. Kiernan Shipka from the Chilling Tales of Sabrina is in it. Who's the actor that plays the FBI agent in Ant-Man, the Asian gentleman? I can't ever remember his name, but he has a bit part in it.
Yeah, it's a good time.
It's a great time.
Up next on Disney Plus, Goosebumps, the new series.
Yet another thing that I was pleasantly shocked by.
And it takes the Flanagan approach to Goosebumps, where it ties a overarching long-form plot in with a bunch of shorter form plots that tie in many of the books from the Goosebumps universe.
And for our older listeners that are, you know, Jordan and I's age, my age particularly or older, I will tell you, it is very Gen Z. And there's a lot of shit that you just kind of have to roll your eyes at because it's like, damn teenagers. And they update a lot of the Goosebumps material that we may have grown up on.
Yeah.
So be prepared to grumble a little bit that it's not your daddy's Goosebumps, but it's really well done. And I was pleasantly surprised by it. I walked into it thinking I was going to fucking hate it.
There was no grumbling on my end. I was loving it.
So up last on Peacock, John Carpenter's Suburban Screams. So this is this is a true crime show, but it's from John Carpenter's perspective. And it's John Carpenter relating true crime to like horror that has influenced him and other directors throughout the throughout the years. And it's pretty brilliant.
And there's even an episode that deals with the Maryland Bunny Man.
Yep.
So this is John Carpenter's latest outing into horror, so we know you guys want to see it.
Yeah.
And we're excited about it, and that's over on Peacock.
It's interesting to see Carpenter sort of, not reminisce, but sort of like wax philosophical on the things that have influenced him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's such a serious guy when it comes to filmmaking. Like, and what I mean by that is that like he takes filmmaking very seriously, and he takes the narratives very seriously, and he takes his influences very seriously. And it's not, you know, he doesn't see genre filmmaking as a joke or I'm not a real filmmaker, which is interesting because a lot of his, I would say, like 80s work and even his 90s work was very campy and very like you could see it as he's not really taking himself. Like They Live is a great example
of. Yeah, it's nice to see like an aged Carpenter like return to it, wax philosophic, as he said. It's just nice to see the royalty return.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I don't know if anybody's seen Studio 666. But that's a great example of the other side of Carpenter, where he like has this bit part in Studio 666 where he's the sound engineer that fucking gets murdered at some point. But like, it's just so silly to see him in that role. And when you add to that the fact that his whole shtick now as a director is he's like, I'll direct, but I don't ever want to leave my house.
Yeah, I don't want to do anything difficult.
I want to believe that he didn't leave his house to make Suburban Screams.
Apparently he did not. He directed it remotely.
I believe that.
Yeah, so that's how they got him to do it, because he said it before. They'll do it, but he can't be hard.
Word.
It's got to be easy.
Well, so that does it for the streaming picks this week. Up last, the trailer of the week, Night Swim. It's coming to Netflix. Just watch it. I don't want to ruin anything about it for you. It looks weird as fuck, though.
Yeah, so go over to the X-Files section of our website. You can check out that trailer of the week. And now let's go ahead and waste no more time and get Kelly Valentine in the room and talk a little bit about the Bell Witch Haunting.
Welcome back, Kelly Valentine.
Happy October, Kelly.
Happy October, guys. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. It's stressful, but it's good.
What you doing? How you celebrate in October down there in Texas?
Hell yeah. Oh, well.
Hey-ya!
And, you know, festive as always, but it's funny because I kind of just embrace that year round. But so actually this happened to me last night at work, where a guy was like, is your hair that big all the time or is it just for the season? And I was like, oh, no, I just look, I was like very, I was like dressed down. last night.
Annual, annual. Look.
And he was like, "You looking pretty spooky?" And I was like, "I just okay."
You're like, this is who I am.
You know, you bring up a good point, because it's like, for those of us who do embrace the spooky lifestyle like, all year round, we have to find new ways to make October special.
Yeah.
So what are some ways that you do that, Kelly? How do you make October special when you're spooky all year?
I feel like this is where Kelly confesses to murder.
Yeah. The short answer is crime.
There's a term they use called escalating.
Short answer, crime. Long answer, violent crime.
The one month a year I allow myself to eat human flesh. So, you know, I get going on the cannibalism.
Yeah. No, it's just long enough to forget the taste, you know?
Exactly.
Like, oh, yes. Like venison.
But I feel like I just like, sorry, my cat is being extra right now.
You say human flesh and the cat just comes calling, you know?
And then he's like, he is a hungry boy. So that kind of makes sense. I feel like I definitely express myself even more so outwardly. I kind of already do that, but I definitely feel more emboldened too, because I'm like, as much as I like being heavily decorated, I don't really like being perceived.
Now, bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, she's saying this covered in tattoos.
Literally. I like looking like this, but I don't want other people to be like, right, you know, always talking to me and asking me questions. Most of the time, it's fine.
Right.
But I do feel more bold to like wear crazier stuff, you know, like I keep wearing this like jack-o'-lantern sweater that I got that I'm obsessed with. Probably gonna wear it all year. But it's definitely now people are just like, oh, cute. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's
like
very
obnoxiously Halloween.
Christmas rolls around. Everyone can wear every dumbass sweater that they have. And like, it's just awesome. And everyone loves it. So yeah, this time of year, you can pull out that stuff.
It's also, even though people hate it, it is slightly more socially acceptable to eat candy corn, which I love.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can pop it publicly and people don't like.
They have to not say anything.
Yeah.
Like the rest of the year, they can be like, that's disgusting. But like in October, I feel like that'd be like, fine.
Yeah. In October, you can carry around like a prescription pill bottle full of, you know, like candy corn and just take it in public and they just have to smile and take it. You know?
I saw a thing on Instagram today where this dude posted a recipe for a candy corn, like candy corn dog, essentially. And it was just a hot dog wrapped in like melted candy corn.
Oh.
And it just, no. It's too far. It's a bridge too far for me. It's just fucking disgusting.
The candied hot dog?
No, it's like a real hot dog covered in melted candy corn.
Yeah, no, the real hot dog, but candied on the outside.
Y'all can't see my face, but I'm making the Nick Miller turtle face. Just
the big.
I love a sweet and savory treat. I'm going to be honest.
My big question is it like, when that happens to the candy corn, does it become like a soft candied outer layer or like something you have to crack through with your teeth, you know?
I think it's soft.
Okay.
I think it's a soft. Like, that would be fucking horrible if you had to bite through that.
If it's like a soft candy coating, I'm in. But yeah, if it's hard like a candied apple, I'm out.
If it's like a fucking turtle shell.
Can you imagine a candied apple with a hot dog center?
Yeah.
I'm not breaking my teeth on that, okay?
And you have to break through a turtle shell of candy.
All three of us gagged at that. Just a soft hot dog center.
Just human flesh on the inside.
That's all I want. So, Kelly, I think this is the first time we've ever talked to you where the rest of the world is not as crazy as Texas. Where Texas is not as crazy as the rest of the world right now.
How's that feel for you?
This is the first time that we've talked to you where you haven't been like, what is wrong with Texas? Like, it's the rest of the world that's nuts right now, not Texas.
Honestly, feels pretty good. It's funny, though, because in my very small bubble of life here, it's, like, always crazy and chaotic. Just
sure,
because,
sure.
Like,
that's because you live in
energy.
Austin.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the energy here, but especially of the bar that I work at. Like,
sure.
There's just always, like, ridiculous. Like, people are just always saying the craziest shit to you.
Yeah.
Just, like, doing the weirdest stuff.
Well, give us some examples as of late. What have you heard that's nuts?
Oh, man. See, what have I heard that's nuts?
She's like, somebody confessed to murder. It's just their thing.
You know, people, so the other day, this like older guy was there and it was a little slow to start. And he started talking to me like right away about my tattoos. And then for, I'm not even kidding, 15 minutes straight of me like cornered in this like back corner of our like pool table area. He's just showing me pictures of his stepson, who is very heavily tattooed. And I was like,
You two would get along. You two have a lot in common, you know, you and that's like the tattooed gentleman.
Right, I know. Right. It was like one of those awkward situations, too, where the tattoos weren't very good.
Oh, yeah.
I had to just be like,
Do you remember?
But he kept trying.
I know that you remember Miss Carol. Kelly, you remember Miss Carol from downtown, Jordan?
She danced a lot.
It's like 3 feet tall.
Yes. Yeah. Shortly, okay. She danced a lot.
So Miss Carol's son, yes, she has a son. Do you remember him, Kelly, the tattoo artist?
The tattoo artist.
She was always trying to get people to let him tattoo them, and all of us were like 100% hard no. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way that guy's going to tattoo me. That's what that story is reminiscent of to me. When Miss Carol, dude, at some point, I guess his name is like JD, and mine is JB, so we were right next to each other in her phone.
You two would get along, too. Yeah, there's
a lot
in common.
So she would call me all the time and leave me these like rambling voice messages, and it was the most uncomfortable shit like ever.
See, I just don't want to get tattoo recommendations from the tattoo artist's mother. That's not where I want to get.
Yeah.
That's not where I want to get like my right resource for the tattoo. I want to find the art and be like, I like this art. Oh, who does it? I just don't want to be like someone my kid does it.
Yeah. This has happened to me multiple times where people have been like, oh, my son or daughter is a tattoo artist, and they'll like show me, and every time it's bad work. So I just running. I feel like the good tattoo artists, their parents are cool.
They're not going to try to sell their kid to you.
Because their kid's doing fine. Their kid's got work.
Exactly. Yeah, they don't need help. This is one of those areas where it's better to research. You need the internet. The internet makes this an easier research thing. I'd rather just look on there than take your word for it.
And to be fair, like, I have friends who are not very discerning when it comes to the tattoos they've put on themselves.
Oh, yeah,
or
we all
put
have
on them.
Those
Kelly
friends.
Is not one of them. Kelly's tattoos are all great. Like, I love your tattoos. Which isn't to say that there haven't been some impulsive decisions with tattoos in your life, because I'm certain that there have. But by and large, the shit that you have has meaning to it and was thought out and is thoughtful.
Yeah, like my grandma always said in a very disappointing voice, well, at least they were done well.
Yeah, exactly. What was the thing I read recently? Go ahead and get that tattoo. Your parents are already disappointed in you.
Just pile them on.
Just get another one. Why don't you?
Back.
All right, so let's get into this. Today we are talking about one of my favorite, I don't know if it's true crime or not, but it's a haunting story. It's in my mind,
it's a little of both, right?
It's the granddaddy of all modern haunting stories in America. It's one of the first like widely reported haunting stories that turned into a nationwide thing. We're talking, of course, about the Bell Witch haunting from Tennessee in the early part of the 19th century. I think what sets, you know, there were plenty of haunting stories at that time. I think what sets this aside is this is one of the first ones that was like documented and then written about in a real way. And there was an actual book published about this within the lifetime of the people involved in the haunting, right? It wasn't like they published this book 100 years after the haunting happened. The definitive text on this, which is still the definitive text on it, was published within like 40 years of it happening. So like Betsy Bell was very much alive when this book was put out, which I think marks a sort of change in how hauntings were reported in our nation. Right. Like this is maybe the first time that like the whole nation got into it. Right. Like it wasn't just like a colloquial or like a local haunting that was, you know, kind of whispered about by the locals until later. Like this immediately got media coverage.
This was like of the day when like this with a nationwide court case, you know, sweeps the nation.
Well, and this almost certainly nothing that happens in this story happened the way they said it happened. Like this is almost certainly a hoax, like a big hoax. I mean,
40 years is still a long time too.
I think there's still a lot of shit that happened that's kind of inexplicable. And that's sort of what makes it great, is that as much of a hoax as it probably was, there's also so much about it that was inexplicable. So,
and it's kind of impossible to tell where one ends and the other begins.
Yeah.
When everything was like oral tradition still for 40 years.
Sure.
You know?
And what we do know is that some shit happened and it was seemingly inexplicable. Even Andrew Jackson, yes, old racist ass, old hickory, Andrew Jackson had an opinion about this. And we'll get to that at the very end of this. We're going to talk about Andrew Jackson's account because it's really funny. Because he was like notoriously a skeptic and he still was like, fuck this place. Like, I'm never going back there.
Yep.
So we're going to do our best to give you the facts about everything as we know them. And we'll let you decide for yourself whether or not it's real. I'm going to tell you up front, I think most of it's bullshit. But like, it's fun bullshit to talk about.
Yeah. And plus, we're living in a post-facts world anyway, right?
It's
so,
it's
like, what the fuck is... Who cares about facts?
I really personally think it is, like, mostly a hoax slash just like mental illness in a time where people did not know what that was. And like just the susceptibility of like believing a person. That's what I was thinking about when it comes to this story, with the fact that like in that time people were like, oh, well, a man is as good as his word, and that's what he said, so it is true. And it's like,
Well, okay. And I think a lot of it springs from John Bell was a gentleman farmer that knew nothing about farming and had a useless piece of property that he just thought was pretty and was trying to make money off of it. A lot of it sprang from the fact that he was broke and needed a gimmick to get people to give him money to come to his farm.
This was years before he would found Taco Bell and and change the world.
Exactly. And Bell Atlantic.
Bell Atlantic as
he was,
well.
He was always living
I
in the shadow.
That John Bell.
Yeah.
He was always living in the shadow of his cousin Alexander Graham Bell.
Yes. And he changed his name from his original name, which was John Taco.
Yeah. Exactly. So between the years of 1817 and 1821, John Bell Sr. and his family were supposedly haunted and tormented in increasingly awful ways by a spirit that they claimed was the ghost of a local witch, Old Kate Batts, on their family property, for which was dubiously acquired at best. The property sits near modern-day Adams, Tennessee, in the Red River Valley. The main source of info for the haunting was Martin V. Ingram's An Authenticated History of the Bell Witch. That's the book I was talking about. It is still, to this day, the major source of info, and it is nebulous and like sketchy at best in terms of facts. It shares the dual distinction of being not only the major source of info in the story, but the first real investigative study of haunting in the U.S. Most everyone involved agreed that at best it's a collection of real opinions, not necessarily fact, but real opinions regarding the haunting, and at worst, a really good source of historical fiction.
So is it full of like interviews with like the living people who experience it?
Essentially, okay. Yeah.
Like law enforcement too?
Someone see that as like the youngest son's just like journal about it.
Yeah. Okay. To the extent that law enforcement was involved, because there wasn't really law enforcement at the time. Mm-hmm. Yes. Either way, there are a lot of accounts that do add up to something. And that's the thing, is that there are some truly inexplicable things that happen.
Yeah.
But like Kelly said, a lot of it could be mental illness. A lot of it could be really, really well orchestrated hoaxes, because again, at the time it was all hearsay, right?
It would have to be one of those two things, because this is coming from multiple sources of people who are experiencing
it. Exactly. That. Exactly.
So that's the one thing that's like, it can't just be, it has to be something at least pre-orchestrated.
Well, and there's
or some group psychosis, or it's real.
But
right?
There's no group psychosis, because literally everybody's account, even of the same thing, differs drastically. Right? Like, that's the thing, is that they would interview, you know, five people about the same incident that all five people were at, and all five of them would have a different narrative about how it went down. There's not even like gleaning fact at some point. But again, I think as it plays out, you'll see that it's a great, you just use the right terminology, is there's a lot of hive think. There's a lot of group
definitely
hysteria.
Herd mentality. For sure.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of I saw this, didn't you see that? Well, you know, now that I think about it, I did see that.
I experienced that actually like kind of a lot bartending, because we get really large groups, like corporate groups of people that come in like after whatever seminar they're at, like this happened recently where it was a group of like 30 of them just like turned on us all of a sudden, because like the girl in charge couldn't bribe the DJ to like skip her ahead in line, and then she threw the clipboard that we like signed checks on at the bartender, so we kicked her out, and like the door guy was like blocking her out, and then she was yelling that he was like pushing her even though he wasn't.
So then somebody else is like, yeah, he's pushing her.
The group closed in on him. It was insane. So, like, that's the kind they all just, like, instantly were like, you pushed her. We saw it. We were like, no, that, like, literally didn't happen.
Well, and more, unfortunately, because of 45, that's become the norm, right, is to, like, group gaslight people. Is that all you need is one person who is charismatic enough to control a crowd, and all of a sudden you have a crowd of people that don't even necessarily believe in what they're saying.
Or know what they're talking about.
Very quickly, And people are very quick to be like, oh, I heard this. I saw this. And like, what? Settle down.
And so that mindset, I think, controls a lot of what happened with the Bell haunting.
Especially because they were living in a time where, like, superstitions and the spiritual world was, like, discussed and, like, believed on a much more realistic way than we do today. Like, it was just accepted as, like, a part of their reality at that point in time.
Well,
you know?
And bear in mind that a lot of the narratives surrounding the Bell haunting happened after the fact. A lot of it was built after the fact. Like, there's very little account of some of this until after everything had happened and people kind of built the narrative to fit what had happened. So a big part of that is actually the precursor to the haunting. Supposedly John Bell went on this, and this is where it all starts, is that supposedly John Bell was coming back from this failed expedition to Colorado where they just took a bunch of gentlemen farmers. So for you, those of you who don't know what a gentleman farmer is or a gentleman explorer, it's a rich guy that wants to be rugged and is not good at it.
Literally just picturing a guy in a tuxedo, like, raking.
That's exactly what it is, though, is that it's that you have all these rich people from, like, the coastal elites that heard stories about real settlers and real farmers and wanted in on that sort of experience, but they didn't want to do the actual work. So John Bell joins this expedition to go explore and maybe settle Colorado in, like, the early 19th century. So, like, 1815, 1816-ish.
That's tough country.
He's coming back from that, and they come through the Red River Valley in Tennessee, which is a beautiful area if you've never been there. It is gorgeous. There's a reason they wrote songs about it. So he's coming back to it, and he sees this plot of land that he absolutely has to have for himself. Now, bear in mind that while John Bell is technically a gentleman farmer, he didn't have that much money, and he's got, you know, some old money that he's basically spent most of, but he's got a little bit left, and he wants to buy this plot of land. Well, this plot of land supposedly already belongs to an old lady that they refer to as Old Kate Batts. She's actually part of the inspiration for the witch in Blair, for the Blair Witch.
Great last name if you're going to be a witch.
I know. Batts is a great last name.
It really is, though.
She's on brand.
Yeah. Referred to as Old Kate Batts. She's literally like 40. Or like, yeah,
exactly. She's, like, 30, she's 31.
Kate Batts.
She's 31 and unmarried, so now she's old.
She's old. Decrepit, yeah. Ancient,
exactly.
Old.
Her womb has dried up.
Leathery old Batts.
Exactly. So... factually speaking, all that we know, this is all that we know, that he came back from Colorado, liked this property, and bought it. However, like I said, legend has it that this property was already claimed, and as much as she lived there, by Kate Batts, and she was, you know, because she was a lady who made her own way without a man involved, she was clearly a witch.
Like, crazy old Batty
Batts.
That's
just how it happened.
I'm going to say I'm suspicious of it.
I know.
I mean, same. Same.
Where'd this house come from?
My wife,
you
built
land?
It? My wife just built a radiator box to cover our radiator in the nursery today, and I was like, you're a witch.
You're like, witch?
Like you're doing woodworking by yourself without me? You're like, a witch.
You made our radiator disappear! She's like, no, it's just underneath the covering. Like, witch! She's a witch!
Yeah, exactly.
She brought it back!
Exactly. So let me be very clear, though. There's no historical record of any of this. This is just like the locally accepted reason that Kate Batts hated John Bell is that he took her land from her. And this is oddly similar to the Blair Witch narrative.
Who
did
he buy
I'm
this
saying.
Land from? This guy's never brought into
the
conversation.
The state of Tennessee.
Like, Tennessee doesn't give a shit.
They went to court over it, though, because she did sell it to him, but he like gave her a bad deal on it and was like shady about it. Something involving like taxes.
Even that, there's no historical record of. That's all just part of Martin Ingram's
book.
Right,
that's just like part of the legend of like how it kind of started there.
Yeah.
Like,
is that he basically gave her like pennies on the dollar for this land.
I said doll hairs, witch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the shit that was happening at that time, though, got me good, sir.
God damn it.
Yeah, and there's a cave that, again, the cave narrative didn't start until way after the haunting had been a thing, that she lived in this old cave on the property and that's where he relegated her to. One way or another, he took control of the property legally, and supposedly Kate swore revenge whilst retreating to her cave. She basically said, I'm going to fuck your family, specifically your daughter, Betsy. So that's the precursor to this story. So 1817 is where everything begins. And it begins the way most hauntings begin, which is just like with some weird shit.
With a drone shot.
Yeah, John Bell with a drone shot.
Yes.
So John Bell sees this strange creature that resembles a dog with the head of a rabbit, which he, of course, fired at immediately, because don't try to figure out what something is. Just shoot at
it. It's a witch. That was a rabbit.
That sounds like really cute.
Maybe.
It's like it's an animal that gets less terrifying as you describe it. You're like, it was a big dog with the head of a rabbit. And you're like, oh, well, okay, well.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, a bunny? Like, if it was a dog with, like, the head of a bear, I'd be like, oh, my God, what the fuck? Like,
I know, that's...
Like, the head of a snake or something. It'd be insane.
Yeah, you should have started top down with that description. You'd be like, it's a bunny rabbit with the body of a ferocious dog. You're like, oh, my God,
but, like,
it got
what
scarier.
About,
like,
but,
what if it was, like, a puppy?
Oh, right.
Also,
yeah.
What about a dog's body is ferocious?
I don't know. The only
ferocious thing.
Like, it was a little like dachshund or like a little like toy poodle or something. Or, like,
oh my god, if it was like.
It's a corgi with mange.
Right. If it was like fucking Pinky's dog, Olive.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. See, you just like picture Olive with like bunny ears, basically.
See, this is just an adorable creature that he's describing. Like, I want to adopt one. This rabbit headed dog.
So his son Drew also saw a giant bird perched on the edge of the property that flew off his. I don't know what about that's weird. It's fucking Tennessee.
Well, then, like, how big of a bird are we talking?
Right, but even if it was, like, a California condor.
I mean, there's, like, really big birds, though, but do you think that they had ever seen, like, a peacock or anything?
Right.
Like, what if it was just, like, a peacock? And
what the hell is that?
Like, I imagine it was just, like, an...
Peacocks exist in these, like, southern states. Like, there's, like, peacocks here in Austin for some reason.
I imagine it was just, like, an overgrown vulture.
I mean, I don't even know if it's overgrown. I bet they're so dumb that they're, like, usually see them in the sky when they look like tiny dots, and then they land near them, and they're like, that fucking thing is huge!
Yeah.
That's super fucking natural, man.
I don't understand depth perception.
Hey, well, that is like a real thing, though. They actually did talk about, anthropologists found that there was tribes of people who had lived amongst like dense forests and like never emerged from dense forests and therefore never saw creatures or anything that weren't very close to them.
Sure.
And they showed them photographs of an animal in the distance and an animal close up, and they really had trouble distinguishing the fact that they were the same size and like understanding that. So it really does have to do with what your brain.
All I can think
perceives.
Of is caveman lawyer on SNL, and he's like, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just a caveman. Your depth perception is it's inexplicable to me.
You tell me the rhinoceros is far away, and to me, I'm just a simple man who sees a teeny tiny rhinoceros."
Right. So Betsy Bell, the daughter, also started seeing a young girl in a green dress swinging from a tree. Now, I've read no less than 5 accounts of this particular sighting.
Oh, yeah, we talked about this.
All of them just say she saw a girl swinging. So I don't know whether that was from, like, her neck or, like, from a swing.
Right. So to me, when I read it, I imagined swinging from a swing because of the word swinging.
Right.
Right. But... Is there a count of the swing being there, or is like the swing a ghost?
No,
too?
And that's the thing is that they don't go into any detail.
Hanging
kind
of makes more sense.
You would assume they would say hanging from the tree.
Right,
know?
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll go the happy route and say that she was just swinging on a swing.
If we're forced to like go by these like less than reputable accounts for everything else, I think we got to go with swinging.
Well, and so lastly, Dean, who was a slave because it was the South in 1817, reported being stalked by an enormous black dog. Now, this is one of the moments that I'm going to pause and say
that was a horse.
That sounds a lot like a Grimm to me. And
oh,
that
sure.
Sounds
yeah.
a lot like an already established. Sort of legendary cryptid that accompanies death in a lot
dog.
Of different cultures.
Yeah,
this just giant
dog.
Black dog.
Right.
And in true haunting fashion, of course, the activity made its way into the house almost immediately. So the family starts reporting hearing strange knocking everywhere. They also reported hearing things literally gnawing on their beds as they slept or tried to sleep. Again, these all seem very like, up until this point, these are sort of like old wives' tales, folklore that had been established in multiple cultures, had just never been written down, right? Other activity reported, including hearing invisible dogs fighting and chains being dragged across the floors. It's hard for me to say that, you know, I don't want to be a dick and say that y'all are just making this shit up, but it really sounds like you're just making this shit up.
Like, also sounds like one of them could be a werewolf, you know, from all the evidence so far. There's gnawing, there's giant black dogs.
Well, and doesn't it sort of have the stink of, like, they all just sort of amalgamated ideas that they had had from folklore about what a haunting would be like? And it goes back to what we're saying about, sure, like, hive mind.
Yeah.
And, like, everybody being like, yeah, I did hear two dogs fighting. And it's like, what does that even sound like? Like, I feel like that would sound different for every set of dogs.
Maybe husband just, you know, gnaws in his sleep, you know?
Yeah. Maybe he's
also like, maybe there were dogs outside fighting. I don't know. They live in the middle of the woods in Tennessee.
With no fucking lights. And you're like, well, they're invisible. You know, yeah. It's just fucking dark outside.
Yeah, there's like coyotes out there.
Yeah, well,
they're invisible too.
Either way, if it's a hoax, it's very well, it's clever on their part because mm-hmm. they sort of build it, right? And this is like the building stage of said hoax. Like, nobody besides the people reporting it have seen any of these things, but they're all sort of collectively agreeing that these things have happened. And like, this is how they build the hoax so that when they do hit, when shit does hit the fan, they can be like, well, see all these building blocks we had for that? And I think that's kind of what they're doing.
So
with
you
this.
Think these guys were smart enough than they were building the long con?
Kind of.
Yeah?
I think that John Bell was a lot worse off than he led people to believe. And we're going to get into that later, that he literally spent all of his money on this property and building this house and had no money left. And
Bank couldn't farm.
Yeah, and he didn't know how, he didn't understand what farming was. Like, that's the whole thing of a gentleman farmer. Like, I've worked for a gentleman farmer. They are obnoxious at best. So this is where the haunting starts to intensify. As with all hauntings that we read about, there's a point where it's like, well, why didn't they just leave? And we've said this myriad times on this show. The only people in the world that are going to sacrifice their well-being for real estate are white people. That's it. There are no other people in the world that are like, yeah, a disembodied voice definitely told us to get out. But the property value, though.
It's also the same kind of deal. He's the only kind of people who are going to, like, go on vacation, essentially, which is what this man did, and be like, this place is so beautiful. We'll live here forever now. Move everything. I don't care if an old lady already owns it. We're moving in.
Exactly. I don't care if she died in it. So in this case, as is with a lot of them, John Bell sank everything he had into this property, and he'd be damned if he gave it up to some old biddy or her witch ghost.
I already moved my things.
That is documented fact that I believe wholeheartedly, that John Bell was like, I have no other options. I have to keep this property.
Sure.
So whether it's I have to keep this property at the expense of my family's safety, or I have to create a haunting so that people will pay me money to come to this property, I don't know.
Is that what ends up happening? That people pay to go
there? Oh, we'll get
there. There.
We'll get there. So old Kate Batts ups the stakes. The children, Betsy in particular.
The Batts is back.
They begin to experience heightened phenomena like bedsheets being ripped off, pinching, scratching. Betsy even supposedly got stuck with pins like in broad daylight in front of people. She'd just be standing there and be like, ah! And drop to the ground. But there was
ghost pins.
This is one of the few points that people can, like, multiple people that viewed it can agree on having seen, was actual pin marks in her that appeared from nowhere.
All right.
That there's actual, like, stab marks that appear on her.
He said that was, like, all of her wounds that she was, like, very actively, like, bruised and, like, cut up. Like, you know, they matched what she, you know, was saying was happening. But on the note, too, people also have suggested that it was her, you know, father who was abusing her, and he was telling her that it was these, you know, entities or whatever.
Yep. And that's we're going to get into that theory at the end of this, because there's a whole movie that was made about this that is predicated on that theory. So anyway, Betsy's getting it the worst at this point. So enter James Johnston. So once this real heavy shit starts happening, and again, this is either the most cleverly planned hoax ever or the stupidest people possibly being haunted. So John Bell goes out and gets his friend James Johnston, who is essentially like the Joel Osteen of his time. He's this like religious spiritual guru that's like a televangelist, essentially, that is like a self-proclaimed expert in spirits and divination and all that, but from like a very evangelical standpoint. So he brings him to spend like a weekend at the house. It takes him one night dealing with this bitch to come back to the Bell family and say, oh, it's for sure a spirit like in the Bible. That's his actual quote, is that it's a spirit like in the Bible.
Just like them spirits you done read about in that Sunday church book, you know?
So at this point, John Bell's like, hey, well, according to John Bell, John Bell is like, hey, please don't tell anybody about this. I don't want a media frenzy. I imagine him saying, yeah, exactly. I imagine him saying that like a wink, wink, like, don't go tell nobody. So, of course,
read aloud at like the local watering hole.
Right.
As he's already releasing a dozen carrier pigeons into the air.
I hope you don't tell anybody about the ghost in my house because I wouldn't want to have to charge people to come hear it. So, of course, Johnston leaves and immediately tells everyone that he knows about this ghost in John Bell's house. So people start showing up from far and wide, to and fro, to see this Bell witch. Mm-hmm. This Bell. And at this point, might I remind you that Kate Batts was already persona non grata in this area. She had died at this point, but she was 100% people hated her because she was an old lady that made her bones without having any men help her.
Well, yeah. And like apparently too, she was like pretty obnoxious.
Yeah,
like she was like a little rowdy, but I'm like, she kind of sounds funny. I don't know.
I think she sounds like she'd be fun to hang out with.
I could see getting annoyed with her, but I feel like, yeah, like I'd have a couple of drinks with her.
I mean, yeah. So maybe she was probably like a frustrated old spinster who drank a lot of moonshine in the woods.
I mean, that's exactly what she was.
And
basically, I mean, from all accounts, from the very beginning, anytime this thing addressed John Bell, it was basically like, fuck you. Fuck you, John Bell. Fuck you. Fuck him. Fuck you. Yeah, exactly. Think like old lady version of Regan in The Exorcist is exactly what I picture. So Johnston goes and tells everybody he knows. And, you know, this is, in my opinion, goes exactly according to John Bell's plan, that people start showing up and paying him good money to spend the night in his house. This is a good place to pause and point out that John Bell was essentially drowning in debt again and not producing anything besides fear. So it leads myself and most modern day historians to believe that he staged this entire fucking thing at this point, from this point forward.
You know, first ever like haunted house attraction, first ever house informant, you know, I'm like, I'm about to pay to go get scared and walk through a bunch of haunted houses.
Yeah, we were just at the Distorted Dreams haunt like last weekend. This guy's like a forerunner in an industry here.
And that's maybe the best. And that's maybe the best analogy that I've heard, Kelly, is it's like the nation's first like haunted house attraction. So this is where the spirit starts speaking. And this is where shit does start to get a little bit inexplicable and where I start to believe maybe they did rile up something. So with the influx of folks coming in to see the spirit work, of course, people start asking it questions, and boy, howdy, wasn't ready to answer. And this is where it really starts to go full Regan from The Exorcist, because it starts bringing up people's like private sex lives when they ask her questions. But before it even gets
like pretty funny,
it absolutely is. So before it even gets to that, the first thing people ask is who are you? What do you want? And it responds immediately with, I'm a spirit that was once happy and now I am not. Which, you know, there's probably some truth there. Like, I'm a firm believer that don't, like, if you fuck around, don't get upset when you find out. Mm-hmm. Period. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you're gonna, like, fuck around, and the Eckharts have taught me a lot about this, too, that, like, you can create familiar spirits like this without meaning to, or you can invite familiar spirits into a place that you did not mean to, just by, and I think that has a lot to do with what happened here. So it starts giving all sorts of contradictory reasons for why it's the first thing it says is that the house is built on an ancient Native American burial mound.
Classic.
That old chestnut.
Classic.
Like, has there ever been an American haunting that didn't involve Native American burial grounds?
Yeah, like, that's just, like, standard. Yeah, it has to.
Yeah, it's never something good. You're like, wow, I get really good cell reception here. What is that? And like, ah.
It's the
Native American spirits from the burial ground that we built on. The cell tower was built directly on top of it. It amplifies it.
And the radioactive waste buried next to it.
Oh, yeah, that'll do.
So it also tells Drew Bell and his buddy that there's buried pirate treasure in a landlocked state.
Yeah, where are they again? They're in
Tennessee.
Tennessee. Pirate treasure.
So there's buried pirate treasure in a landlocked state that it sends Drew Bell and his friend. Drew Bell is John Bell's oldest son. So it sends Drew Bell and, or oldest living son, sorry, and his buddy on basically a wild goose chase for like a year trying to find this buried treasure all over the property.
Trying
which
to find the Native American
I imagine that
treasure.
Was real fun for John Bell to watch his idiot son just digging up his yard.
He's rolling his ankles, stepping in holes. He's like, God damn it, I told you to stop digging for that treasure.
He goes outside, he's like Kevin Bacon in Stir of Echoes, and he just dug up the whole backyard. Like,
yes. Yeah. But either way, this part of the haunting is still fairly harmless. It's funny as fuck, but it's... And then, like, everyone that comes to ask it a question, it's just like, the spirit will be like, and I know you fucked your wife in the ass last night. And it's just like, wow, that's not the question that I asked you. But I was...
Yeah, that's relevant.
I was asking how my mom was, but that's fine. That's fine.
And she said she liked it, but she lied. She actually loved it.
So we're calling it She now instead of It, because at this point, it names itself as Kate Batt's ghost.
Yeah.
Essentially. Before then, it had not really named itself. Everybody just assumed it was Kate Batt's, but at this point, it starts responding to Kate specifically.
Everyone else was just referring to it previously as Mr. or Mrs. Spirit that was once happy and is now not.
Yeah, and of course, in true 19th century ghost fashion, it starts quoting scripture randomly at people, which is always fun.
Uh-huh.
In between telling people about getting ass fucked, it quotes scripture.
That's like at the time, though, that's the same version of like quoting Chappelle's Show to everybody or something like that. It's just, you know, you're quoting pop culture.
Yeah. Before memes, it was just a whole bunch of bros shouting Chappelle quotes at each other.
Shouting biblical scripture at each other. Like, sick, dude. Oh, yeah.
It was the equivalent of us shouting Anchorman quotes.
Yeah.
So to go back to the theory that Kelly brought up about John Bell abusing and sexually assaulting Betsy Bell, this is where the ghost does start to say things like that, sort of in passing. Like, hey, remember the time you fucked your daughter, John? And John Bell's like, whoa.
That's figure of speech.
That was a figure of speech. I don't know what you're talking about. That's what I mean when I say that it just starts, like, exposing people's sex lives secrets at random. So John Johnston, who was James Johnston's son, comes up with this foolproof plan to trick this spirit into exposing itself as fake.
Gotta love
and says,
plans.
Can you tell me, he goes to the spirit and says, can you tell me what my old Dutch granny who lives in the Netherlands says to her slaves when they make a mistake? Not only does it quote his granny exactly, it does so in her voice, according to everyone in the room. And this is another one of those few moments in this narrative that everyone agrees on, that not only did it quote that woman precisely, the hut tut, what's going on now, or whatever that phrase was, but it does so in this woman's voice, which, that's terrifying.
Does it in the racist granny's actual voice?
Yes, exactly. And there's another incident reported, right? Couldn't help but notice the use, the just excessive use of the N-word, ma'am.
I know you're a demon, but come on.
You would think that you guys would rise above racism.
Problematic. You're problematic.
Exactly. There's another incident that was reported around the same time when an Englishman that had come to stay and was one of the myriad people that had come to find out about this challenges the ghost to report on his family in England that the ghost could know nothing about. And the ghost speaks to him in his dead parents' voices exactly. And at the same, so the Englishman obviously fucking hightails it the next day. He's like, I'm out. So he sends the Bells a letter like a month later from England saying that at the exact same time, his family was woken up in the middle of the night by his voice clearly speaking to them like irreverently.
Irreverently.
So like, that's kind of inexplicable. And again, like maybe they did, you know, taunt something to the extent where they woke it up. Who knows?
Yeah. So, I mean, it could. So it either could have been real the whole time, or they could have just fucked around and then started finding out.
Well, and again, while all this is fairly harmless as far as people actually being physically harmed, bear in mind that the witch ghost was getting progressively more and more, like, mean and nasty with the shit that they would say to people in the house. Like, it started out, it was just like, ooh, I'm a ghost, I'm so scary. Now it's just like, what, Jesus, fuck me. So this is when things start to get, like, nasty. So around 1820 or so, the spirit started not just saying things, but straight up attacking people in the house. Like, specifically Betsy, it was like throwing Betsy down the stairs, and like, she would show up with bruises all over the place. It was fucking John up all over the place. And there's the generally accepted theory that Betsy's abuse was coming straight from John, and that John was basically just beating the shit out of her and gaslighting her.
Yeah, that's the easy answer to all this, and is it's that the John's probable, beating the hell out of
and
everybody.
And it's the probable answer, unfortunately.
Right. Well, you said John got injured, too. How did John get injured?
So early on in the haunting, John experienced paralysis of the mouth. Like, his mouth would just stop working, and it would start drooping, and no one knew why. A lot of people think that that was Betsy actually poisoning him.
Oh.
I really love this theory. This is, like, the theory that I kind of go with here, is that she really was, like, getting abused. And, like, it's also people who are under abuse like that will go along with anything and say anything.
Yeah.
You know, you created this hysteria. He's like basically a mini cult leader, you know, but I like to think that she just like slowly started poisoning him because she was like, I need to get the fuck out of here. And this is the only way I can do it. Like, kill him, like poison him. Cause they found like a jar of like some like mystery substance, and they gave it to the family cat, and the cat like died.
Immediately.
They were like, oh, that's not good.
We got to stop testing things in the family.
Yeah. So, she was testing these poisons on her father early on, and that's like what gave him paralysis of the mouth, and like what, you know, it was like an early form of Bell's palsy, is what they called it. But either way, around 1820 is when it starts to get to ramp up hard. And I think a lot of it was him beating her more and her retreating into this mental illness and just not. Or not even a mental illness. I would say like an imposed trauma.
Yeah. Just and closing off.
So in 1821, things reach a climax when John is, quote unquote, mysteriously poisoned to death. This is my favorite fact about
the ghost done about, juiced him up full of poison.
This is my favorite part of this narrative ever. At his wake, at not even his funeral, at his wake, where they have like his body resting in state in the house, his family and all the mourners are trying to sing like hymns and shit, and every time they do, the ghost bursts out with like some lewd or lascivious drinking song. So like they're trying to sing "Nearer, My God, to Thee," and the ghost is like, "There once was a lad from Nantucket."
The
like,
from the voice was coming from where?
Just
according to them,
just out of nowhere. Like it was just that's the whole this whole time. This according to everybody, this voice was just disembodied.
They just kept singing Dropkick Murphy songs every time they tried to like see do some religious shit.
Just exactly. Hats up in the rafters.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, yeah, just trying to mourn this guy and shipping off to Boston's playing out of nowhere. Baby, I'm an anarchist.
Yeah. What's the other one? Flogging Molly. There's the other one.
Well, so after John dies, the ghost, as it said up front, was upset, and this is another reason that people think it was a weird sort of paradigm between John and his daughter, because the ghost doesn't just go away after he dies. It switches its attention to Kate, or to Betsy. So Betsy's all geared up to marry this guy, Joshua Gardner, who is like an actual farmer that is made well, and she's like geared up to get the fuck off this property, get the fuck out this family.
Grow some real food.
She's gonna go live on a farm where she can actually make money, and the ghost basically ain't having it. And it ramps up its attacks on Betsy to the point where Betsy calls off the wedding with Josh Gardner, and lo and behold, the haunting stops.
I'm too haunted to marry you.
However,
sorry, honey.
Before it completely ends, the ghost does tell her, I'll be back in 7 years. I'm going to keep tabs on you. And if you try to get out of this house in any way, I'm coming back in 7 years, 1828, and I'm fucking your whole life up.
The ghost like goes into this much detail, according to her, to explain all of this.
Which
shit?
Again is why a lot of people think it's her mental illness causing her
to. Part of it too is so there was like she had this teacher who was very interested in her and wanted to marry her, but he was in his like mid-30s, and apparently she like wasn't into him, wanted to marry this guy, you know, Josh Gardner, who's like 18, who's like closer to her age, you know, she's actually excited about. So people were theorizing that like her teacher was the one that was like creating all of this, because a lot of it focused around her getting married and her calling it off.
It's basically Gone with the Wind if instead of having Ashley killed in the Civil War, Rhett Butler just haunted Just like fake haunted Scarlett O'Hara.
Did a fake haunting. Yeah. That's how I get, you know, most of my dates.
I mean, otherwise, same. I mean, the ghost could just be that detailed, you know? Have you ever, like, you know, been in a haunted house, take a really hot shower, and you, like, come out, and there's, like, a full paragraph of explicit details written in the mirror of exactly what you need to do, you know?
It's just, it's four pages.
Like, hold on, I got to get through clause two here.
It's four pages of Pride and Prejudice. Yeah, except Mr. Darcy haunts you in this one.
My ADHD is not reading all that. Okay.
Something like, blah de blah, 7 years. Yeah, I skimmed it, all right?
I saw seven.
7 years, yeah. I kind of dozed out and we're in the middle there, but yeah, I more or less read it.
Well, so according to Betsy's family, after she calls off the wedding, the witch does come back briefly in 1828 to torment Lucy, who is John's widow. But Lucy has had enough at this point and just fucking ignores it and it goes away. Like, according to her account, is that the witch came back like for like a night and she was like, I don't have time for you. And the witch was like, all right, see you later.
Ain't no one got time for that.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But here's something. All right. So the legacy of this is what's more interesting, in my opinion, than the actual haunting, is that this sort of becomes a carte blanche scapegoat for everyone that gets in trouble from here on out for the rest of the 19th century. Is like, there are multiple court hearings where people are being tried for everything from like petty larceny to murder, where they're like, Bell Witch made me do it. And like,
that's hilarious.
It becomes like, at least at first, like an accepted like plea. That they're like, I didn't do this. The Bell Witch did this.
The old Bell Witch defense.
But it was because this was the first like widely reported haunting in America that, you know, we were also going through like a heightened state of like religious fervor in our nation at the time. Mm-hmm. But people were literally using the Bell Witch as their scapegoat for everything.
Wow.
And there were all sorts of hauntings throughout the rest of the 19th century where people would say, oh, it's the reemergence of the Bell Witch. And that's how they would get people to come to their haunted house, which is, you know, kind of what Kelly pointed out, that this was the first like haunted house attraction, and it kept playing on as that.
These other places are like, we booked the Bell Witch this year. We got her.
She's the best scare actor around.
Well, and even throughout the 20th century, the Bell Witch house was one of the first like haunted attractions, if not the first haunted attraction in our nation, that people still go to that property to this day to be haunted, essentially.
He's still making money on that.
Yeah, dude.
It's the longest haunt in America.
And the first ever Taco Bell is at a little tiny little like wooden like lemonade stand on that property.
Exactly. So from this point forward, the witch basically becomes a convenient, like I said, a convenient scapegoat, a convenient reason for everybody to be haunted in the nation. And of course, everyone has profited off the legend since then. A lot of people have added their own accounts, a twist to the story, making it the first real modern day folk horror story in America. To the point where I would say like the definitive movie regarding this is An American Haunting, starring Donald Sutherland from 2005, I believe. And it basically is predicated on the narrative of Betsy was abused by her father and she killed him. And that's and created this haunting narrative, but like the movie goes into like she kind of did create another entity that killed for her, even though it was her doing the killing. Like it was some mommy dearest shit.
And I think if you watch the Blair Witch Project, you'll see how much this is like part of the DNA of that movie too, and just how like especially the interviews at the beginning were like it's like groupthink and group psychosis and everyone blames everything on the Blair Witch, and anything that possibly goes wrong is the Blair Witch's fault. And I mean, regardless of the Blair Witch being a real entity in that movie at all, looking at how like the story gets passed down and how views it.
And I think that Ed specifically used this as the backbone for a lot of the Blair Witch
seems like it
narrative. But yeah, so my favorite account of anybody's account is Andrew Jackson. So if you all don't know who Andrew Jackson is, he was the president that committed the Trail of Tears. He's the president that displaced literally millions of First Nation and American Indians from their original home of like Florida, Tennessee area, all the way to the Southwest. It's called the Trail of Tears. He was a horrible human being. Before he was president, he was a military hero from the War of 1812, specifically the Battle of New Orleans. He helped win it. Mm-hmm. But he was known as Old Hickory because he was a hard man. And
as hard as hickory, or because he whipped
everyone? No, he just
with
walked
hickory.
Around with an erection all the time.
He was literally he was a boner of a man.
He was a boner of a dude.
He has a man of a boner.
Old Hickory.
Old Hickory. But so he encountered this house multiple times, and I think the definitive one is he got knocked off his horse because he was a skeptic the first time and was like, fuck this, there's nothing going on here. I don't believe in demons. I don't believe in ghosts. And he was on his way to the house, and Kate Batts knocked his ass off his horse and was like, fuck you, Old Hickory.
And that's dangerous when you have an erection, too.
It is. He fell right onto it, broke his dick.
Oh, it shattered into a thousand pieces.
He fell right onto it, broke his dick.
It breaks like glass when it's in that state. I didn't know if you knew that.
But so, I mean, he never, or that might have been the last. I think before then he had sent his underlings to go investigate it, and they had all had haunting experiences. And so finally he goes and gets knocked off his horse before he even gets there. He doesn't even make it to the house. And he's like, fuck that. I'm never going back there ever again.
It's like, well, technically you haven't been there. But it's like, well, I'm never going back, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess the first night they were all, like, really talking shit and were, like, laughing at, like, other people being scared and stuff. And they made it through the first night. Some weird stuff happened. They're like, whatever, we'll stay another night. And the second night, they were like, fuck no. Like, I guess, a bunch of stuff because they kept talking shit.
Yeah. Well, and
they
again,
all got scared so fast.
I'm not above believing that the Bells did invite some sort of entity into their into their lives. Do I believe that it was old Kate Batts? Absolutely not. Do I believe that they fucked around long enough that they also found out? Yep, I do. And I think that that's the entity that these people are like, you know, when they talk, nobody likes to be made fun of, especially not demons.
Right. Just or angry ass ghosts.
Yeah. Well, so there you have it, folks. There is our account of the Bell Witch haunting.
What do you think?
Tell us what you think. Tell us. I mean, I'm sure some of you think it's real. I'm sure some of you have some of your own stories to share about the
Fact
Bell Witch
or fiction.
Yeah. Thank you again, Kelly, for coming and hanging out with us. We love you. You started this whole true crime and Halloween.
Yeah.
On Halloween, like three, four years ago, right?
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah.
So you got any plans for the holiday itself this year? Anything cool?
Well, I'm working on actual Halloween, so that'll be fun. Decorated my bar for Halloween. It's all like killer carnival themed.
Hell yeah.
I have set up a few costumes. I'm going to do this like really cute like pink Pennywise.
Yeah.
Get us, of course. And then I'm going to do Terrifier Art the Clown again because I've done it the last couple of years and it just keeps evolving and becoming like more grotesque.
And what better way to terrify people in a real way than, because like the whole premise of art is that it takes place on Halloween in a completely unassuming
public
setting
place.
Like that.
Yes, exactly. Last year, people were so unsettled by my costume and it was so funny for me.
Love
and
that.
I wore it like I went to my like work to hang out and people like did not know it was me and they were just like upset. They were like, you are very scary. People are so scared of clowns as it is.
Yeah, people hate clowns.
So I'm going to do an even more involved one this year. Otherwise, me and my boyfriend are going to be the Dudley Boys.
It's
the Dudley Boys red camo variant. Of course, that's the best version.
What is that from? What are the Dudley Boys from?
The tag team from
Attitude
Era.
Okay.
I'll send you a picture. It's going to be really good. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Well, again, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Thank you so much for talking.
Yeah.
Not true hauntings, but a haunting with us.
Yeah. It's always a treat. Thank you so much,
Kelly. Yeah. We wish you nothing but the best. And I'm sure that we're going to be talking to you sooner than later again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
All right, buddy.
Bye, Kelly.
Later.
Bye, guys.
So there you have it. We are always so happy and so thankful when Kelly comes to hang out with us. We wish her all the best in her Halloween pursuits. She is definitely going hard on people as Art the Clown. And there, you know what the thing is, like that mask in particular is like really unsettling, especially if you don't know who's underneath it.
Oh yeah,
that's the thing is that like you know you could temper that scare by like speaking and letting someone know you're underneath it, but something tells me Kelly's not doing that.
No, she's not, not her kind of thing.
So if you dug what we had to say, if you have opinions on what we had to say, which I'm sure a lot of you little monkeys do, please feel free to go to campnightmare.com. You can get to all of our social media through there and be as opinionated as you'd like. While you're there, you can also check out the X-Files in the extra section.
And if you guys just want more camp, head over to patreon.com/campnightmare. You can get access to all kinds of good stuff like exclusive episodes. Our most recent secret episode for October, we broke down H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond.
Yeah.
I do a dramatic reading of the original story, and then we compare it to Stuart Gordon's cinematic adaptation.
Which is fucking bonkers.
And still my favorite Stuart Gordon Lovecraft movie. So that was a lot of fun. That's only on Patreon.
You know, I think I agree with you now.
It's
honestly
so good.
Like, I think when I think about, like, Reanimator is up there for me because it's just so brilliant.
Yeah,
but,
great.
Like, I think From Beyond might be my favorite, too.
Because it's, yeah, it's so extra.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, as always, we would be remiss if we didn't swing you towards our two sponsors. Number one, Special Tees, special-tees.com for all your printed merch needs. They are the place to go, man. Hannah and crew will take care of you. Number two, Wonder Book and Video, wonderbk.com for their online resources. Or if you're in Maryland, you can go to 3 brick and mortar locations, Gaithersburg, Frederick, and Hagerstown, for all of your books, DVDs, Blu-rays, vinyl, video games. They have it all, guys. We shop there all the time, and it really is just the coolest place. It's like the last bastion of, like, physical media.
And yet, Wonder Book is thriving. So go support them and go check out their digital or physical space.
Yeah. As always, guys, my name is JB.
And I'm Jordan.
Even back in 1821, nothing was real.
And don't tell us what to do.
Thanks for listening to Camp Nightmare. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Slasher. And for full campfire tales, interviews, X-Files, and more, visit campnightmare.com.
And join our Patreon community of happy campers for monthly secret episodes, exclusive merch deals, B-movie watch-alongs, access to our Discord channel, and more. Visit patreon.com/campnightmare.